Last time we ended on the note that there was a prophecy that was given to Zerubbabel. That seems rather enigmatic in the light of later events. That we read about it in Zechariah. I mean, were we in Zechariah or Haggai? I forget now. We looked at a number of prophecies about Zerubbabel, and we saw that they seem to have a messianic content, and as a result, the people got very ambitious in responding to the prophecies that were given through Haggai and Zechariah, and as a result, they became quite diligent and actually got the temple built. Something we might mention also in Haggai chapter 2. I was looking for it before and wondered why I didn't find it exactly worded the same way. In Haggai chapter 2, we looked at verses 20 through 23, but we hadn't looked at one of the earlier ones where it's interesting the way it's put. In chapter 2 of Haggai, beginning in verse 6, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, yet once it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land. I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory. And of course, that was interpreted again as being a messianic prophecy, in which they began to apply to their own day. So, I would say that this helps to account in part for the tremendous fervor which they showed in getting the work done. I'm trying to think of the prophecy we ended with in Zechariah had to do with Zerubbabel, where God tells him that his hands shall begin and also finish the building of the house. Yes, thank you. The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundations of this house. His hands shall also finish it. Now, the problem with that is, from secular history, as I ended with this point last time, we know that by 519 BC, all governors of Persian provinces who came from the royal house of the family of the country they governed were removed. And therefore, Zerubbabel might still very well possibly have been in Jerusalem and involved with the work, but he certainly wasn't in charge of it. He definitely was not in charge of it. Now, how can we resolve this? Of course, one way of saying, well, maybe it didn't mean he had to be in charge of it. He'd just be around for it. And that's one way, of course, of resolving it. And there's another way of resolving it, and that is to consider something that God said to Elijah back in 1 Kings 19. 1 Kings 19, after Elijah had sort of let loose some of his frustrations on God's shoulders, as we sometimes do ourselves, God said to him in 1 Kings 19, verse 15, this, of course, is while Elijah was at Mount Sinai, you might say undergoing spiritual renewal, that the Eternal said to him, go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you come, anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, shall you anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint to be prophet in your room. Now, Hazael was supposed to be anointed by Elijah. Jehu was supposed to be anointed by Elijah by this command. And Elisha, of course, is his successor. But when you look into it, you find that Elijah never anointed Hazael. And he never anointed Jehu. So you have an interesting thing. God says, you shall do this, and you shall do that, and you shall do that. And he did none of those things. Except, of course, the last. He anointed Elisha, in a sense, as his successor. We find that Elisha was responsible for the anointing of Hazael. That Elisha is the one who sent one of his followers to anoint Jehu. He didn't even do it personally. He sent one of his followers. He gave him the oil and told him how to do it and what to do, and he went off and did it. So in a sense, the commission was followed not by Elijah directly, but by his successor. And yet apparently God didn't seem to feel that was an inconsistency when he told him in advance, you know, you shall do these things. So maybe we can draw some instruction from that in the case of Zerubbabel, that although this was said that he would finish it, seemingly in charge, that it is met and fulfilled in the same way, the same spirit, that through his successor it would be met and fulfilled. So that is a possibility as well. So as I say, you've got those two possibilities. One, he might not have been in charge when it was finished, but still around. In that sense, he might have finished the work. And the other possibility is that, as in the case of Elijah, Elijah never fulfilled directly those commissions, but through his a successor, he did. And therefore, it was the same work being done, but by two individuals, you know, one being the successor to the other. Well, it would be rather a redundancy here to see that his hands has laid it, his hands shall also finish it, meaning the foundation. That's possible, I guess, but it would be an awkward construction. It seems to be an awkward construction to look at it that way. Okay, let's get into now, where that was the thing that I left hanging from last time, to today's lecture. The temple was then finished in 515, because when we go back to the book of Ezra, we find that they had kept on building and eventually even secured a renewal of royal support from Darius. Not surprising that Darius would have given it. First of all, it had been authorized by Cyrus, and secondarily, Darius was struggling to maintain his hold on the empire, and why cause disaffection, you know, among these people. So he had two reasons for reconfirming the order that it be finished. And so they finally did get it finished. And as it says in chapter 6 of Ezra, verse 16, the children of Israel, the priests, the Levites, and the rest of the children of the captivity kept the dedication of the house of God with joy. And we find in verse 20 again that it was at the time of the Passover. The priests and the Levites were purified together. All of them were pure and killed the Passover for all the children of the captivity, for their brethren, the priests, and for themselves. And the children of Israel, which were come again out of the captivity, all such as had separated themselves from filthiness of the heathen of the land to seek the Eternal, the God of Israel, did eat, meaning of the Passover. And they kept the feast of unleavened bread 7 days with joy, for the Eternal had made them joyful and turned the heart of the king of Assyria to them to strengthen their hands in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel. Some people have wondered, well, why does it say the heart of the king of Assyria? It was the emperor of Persia. Well, because the emperor of Persia was a successor to the king of Babylon, who was a successor to the king of Assyria. This is just in the sense in which it is used. That is the... remember that when they were conquered initially by the Assyrians, they never regained fully their independence. They simply passed from Assyrian control into Egyptian control, and then passed into Babylonian control, and then passed into Persian control. And so they had been incorporated, you might say, into the Assyrian Empire. So whoever had become the suzerain of the Assyrian Empire was now their ruler. First the Egyptian pharaoh, and then the Babylonian king, and then, of course, the Persian king. That's the sense in which it's meant. Now, things seem to end here on a very, very high note. Now, the trouble is that the next chapter begins with this very sort of unassuming phrase. Now, after these things, in the reign of Artaxerxes, the king of Persia, Ezra the son of Sariah, the son of Azariah, the son of Hilkiah, the son of Shalom, the son of Tzadok, the son of Achitub, the son of Amariah, the son of Azariah, Merioth, Zerahiah, Uzi, Buki, and so on and so forth, and so forth, all the way back to Aaron, the chief priest. This Ezra went up from Babylon. Now, the purpose of this shortened genealogical chart is to show that Ezra is not just a priest, but is also from a very distinguished line of priests. Because not only is he a son of Aaron by descent, which all priests were, but you'll notice that fairly close in the genealogy is mention of Hilkiah. Hilkiah was the high priest in the days of Josiah, you see. And so therefore he is from a very distinguished line. This is one little piece of information that is mentioned to sort of give you some idea of his standing in the community. Now, the chapter opens with, now after these things. Now, normally, if you just read that phrase, we've just finished reading about the finishing of the temple and its dedication, you'd think, well, a few months later, a year or two later, you know, this is what happens. However, this nice little unassuming phrase, after these things, covers a fairly extensive span of years. Because it says, this Ezra went up from Babylon. But what year is given for this event? In verse 8, we read this. He came to Jerusalem in the fifth month, which was the seventh year of the king. The seventh year of King Artaxerxes. Well, the seventh year of King Artaxerxes is either 458 or 457. There's a little bit of ambiguity there. And that's the way it's usually shown in the literature. Now, when was the temple finished and dedicated? 515. Do a little bit of subtraction. 15 take away 8 is 7. 10 take away 5 is 5. That's 57 years later. You have a gap of 57 years, which is nicely covered over by that very unassuming phrase, now after these things. So this should alert us in the future that when you see little phrases like after these things or then, that maybe you shouldn't just assume automatically it means immediately, that one should check and see, well, how long is that? Because in some cases, as in this particular instance, you've got a gap of 57 years. 57 years later, after the dedication of the temple, Ezra comes up to Jerusalem. Now, we're given some specific information about Ezra in verse 6. Ezra went up from Babylon. He was a ready scribe in the law of Moses. What does it mean when it says he was a ready scribe? What maybe other adjective would we use today that would be more sensible? Mary? Skilled, yeah. A skilled, knowledgeable, competent scribe in the law of Moses. Now, why did being a scribe of the law of Moses require competence and skill? I mean, what is involved that makes it so difficult? Well, one of the things that made it difficult to be a skilled scribe is that the common language of the people in this 5th century was what? Exactly. But in what language is the law of Moses written? Hebrew. Now, it's a kindred language, but it's not exactly identical. It's comparable from, let's say, going from Norwegian to Swedish, or Swedish to Norwegian, or maybe German to Dutch, or vice versa. You know, there's a great deal of similarity, but it's not exactly identical. I chose those examples because I know that they're pretty close. I think they approximate the closeness that we have here. And so one had to be knowledgeable in the ancient language, which was no longer being used as a common everyday language or speech. So that was one thing that made it necessary, that we had to know Hebrew, which was no longer being used as a spoken language. The second thing that was necessary is that the copies of the scriptures they had were written without any vowels or any signs or symbols to represent vowels. Today, if you pick up a printed Hebrew Bible, there again are no vowels. However, there are little dots and dashes under the letters. One looks like this, one looks like that, one looks like this, one looks like this, another one looks like this, and then there's one, one is a combination of a apostrophe and that, and there's another vowel which is symbolized this way, and then there's just the dot under it, single dot, and sometimes there's a dot in the middle, and sometimes there's a dot at the top of a letter. Those signs and symbols represent all the vowels, these being an ah sound, this being an eh. It's a half vowel, an A, I, E, E, U, and O. So that's how you can read the text today. You use this system of dots and dashes, and these little symbols tell you what the vowels are. But when were these vowels invented? And begun? When did they begin to be inserted in the text? If you've had biblical scholarship, you should know. Alan? Masoretes. Thank you. Masoretes, that's why we call it the Masoretic text. If you look in an English, Hebrew Bible printed here in this country in the English title page, it will say according to the Masoretic text. It's according to the way the Masoretes had it and the vowelification that they designed. But that was done when? Pardon? Well, some would say a little later, some would say 9th even. So somewhere in that period, 9th or 8th century AD, these vowels were developed and began to be widely used. So there were no markings whatsoever before that for the vowels. Well, then how then could one read the text if there are no vowels? Well, one had to be taught by somebody who knew. And then you taught others so that the transmission would go down the line. So, obviously, this was not so easy to read a text that had no vowels. Today, if you go to a synagogue and ask someone there to pull out a copy of the law from the ark where it is kept and to unroll it, and you were to look at the text, you would again see a text with no vowels. Because this is the way that it is read in the synagogue. It is read without vowels. They still continue to write copies of the Torah without the vowels. Now, however, they do something today that was not done in Ezra's day. And that was, there was a third problem. What was that? Many of you, I think, are aware of it. Or should be. Joey? Right. No word separations. Everything just continued. The Romans did something similar frequently, too. They wrote their words, well, of course, they used vowels, but they didn't break the words either. At least because there are vowels there, at least just makes it a little easier to read it, though. Makes it a little more cumbersome, but at least it can be read. Now, to give you an idea of what this might have looked like, some of you have seen this before because I've only got one. You know, to do it that fast, I've got to have it pretty much down. If I slow down, it gives you a chance to assume that where the word breaks are. You see, if I keep going at the same speed, you can't tell that easily. Now, I chose a very well-known verse. How many of you can identify it? Oh, boy. Either you're getting sharper or you've seen this before. Okay. But you can get an idea of that, you know, to someone who hadn't, you know, they'd be puzzled for a while, and because it's so well known, they would probably figure it out before too long. But what if it was a more obscure passage? Then you'd really be up a tree as to which one it was being chosen. Obviously, this takes a lot of training. Long years of training to be able to correctly read and separate different portions of the law. Now, it's interesting that we have preserved for us the fact that the scribes did not transmit this tradition with perfection. For example, in the King James Version of the Bible, in Proverbs, I believe it's 26, maybe it's 23, I'll have to see now. Yeah, here it is. 26. Verse. Well, let's start so we get the context. Verse 22. The words of a talebearer are as wounds. They go down into the innermost parts of the belly. Burning lips, or a better translation might be flattering lips, lips that flatter. And a wicked heart, in other words, the combination of lips that flatter you and a wicked heart inside of that person. He's hiding his real feelings. He just flatters you, but he's got this real hostile feeling to you inside. Are like a potsherd covered with silver dross. Now, that makes absolutely no sense. It's absolutely no sense. Because first of all, the literal Hebrew is the silver of the dross. Dross is the slag left over when you refine silver ore to get the silver metal. So there's nothing left in the slag. It's pure slag. There's nothing precious about it. Plus, what does silver dross have to do with potsherds anyway? It doesn't make any kind of a sensible analogy. But in the text, using, again, Roman-style letters, because most of you can't read Hebrew, that was the word. I mean, they knew the word on the other side of this, and the word on the other side, that there was a break here and a break here, that this had to be worked with. And when the scribes, the Masoretes, looked at this, either they already had a tradition, or somewhere along the line the tradition got garbled. The only place it made sense to them to break this was here. And this, when you put in the vowels, becomes silver. And when you put in the vowels here, it becomes dross. And so that's why it appears in our King James translations in this fashion. Now, as a result of archaeological research at Ugarit, a city on the Syrian coast, which belonged to the Phoenician culture anciently, they uncovered a totally new language, which wasn't the Phoenician language. It was a separate language called Ugaritic, as you can imagine. And when they found some schoolboy dictionaries with the unknown Ugaritic language on one side and companion words on the other side, in Akkadian, which of course is an ancient language they could read, they could immediately unlock what this language was like. And they came across something that showed them that what happened here is they had made a mistake. They should not have broken the words here and stuck in these vowels this way. That what they should have done, well, maybe what I'll do is I'll leave it this way and do it underneath. Because they knew that somewhere in here is where the break was, is it should have been broken here. This was one word. Sap. Well, that would be shva. Sap sagin. And this should have been just k. It should have been kusaf sagim, not kesef sagim, but kusaf sagim. Because they found that the prefix k is translated in from Hebrew into English as the word like or as. Like or as. It's a word that is making a comparison. And saf sagim is the word for glaze. Now that makes a whole lot more sense. I think the RSV has the change. Am I correct? Or is it one of the newer translations? Who's an RSV? Anybody with an RSV? Nope. Everybody's wedded to the King James. What does the new King James have? Silver dross. In other words, they haven't profited from the new research. They just blindly followed the error. Okay. It's interesting. It shows you there are weaknesses then in these different translations. I think it's the RSV that has this correctly indicated. Because without doubt, this is the way it should have been translated. Because when you stop to think about it, now it makes a sensible analogy. Flattering look, lips, is something that makes you feel that the person thinks well of you. It looks good on the outside. But inside, there's rottenness. There's a hostility. And it's just like a potsherd. What is a potsherd? It's dull, uninteresting clay. But it's made to look good by putting a glaze on the outside. So the wickedness of the heart is made to look good by the flattering lips. In the same way, a dull, uninteresting potsherd, when it's glazed, looks very interesting. And so it makes a sensible analogy. And as I said, the reason is that apparently this word, for which a similar word existed in Hebrew, passed out of common usage. And because of an error in the transmission of the meaning of the text, they no longer recognized it, and so the only other way it made sense to break it was this way, though the analogy made no sense. And so that's the way it entered into the text. Now, there is, of course, a very famous instance in the text where something has dropped out of the text, and there are suspicions of at least one other place where maybe something dropped out of the text. The one where it is obvious something dropped out of the text, at least in the Hebrew version, is in 1 Samuel chapter 13. Our English versions say Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, Saul chosen 3,000 men of Israel. Literally, the Hebrew text says Saul was 1 year old when he began to reign. Now, that doesn't make any sense. Now, the Jerusalem Bible, which I think was put out by the Catholics, has an interesting way of trying to justify it. I think there's a marginal note that says in the Jerusalem Bible, this is to reflect the purity of his and innocence of his beginning as a king, which later, of course, changed. And that's why the text says he was like a one-year-old child when he started to reign. But of course, that's a very interesting thought that has nothing to do with the grammar of the text. What has happened is that a number dropped out. The number that went with the one dropped out. And what it is, we don't know. What also seems very strongly to have been something that dropped out of the text, though we can't be 100% sure, as we can in 1 Samuel 13, that it's very obvious something dropped out, is in Genesis chapter 4, a very famous encounter between Cain and Abel. Now, it's covered over very nicely in the King James. I should remember to bring another translation where it shows it more clearly. No one has another more modern. What does it say in the New King James around verse 8? Who wants to read? Who has a New King James? I'm curious how it has it. Why don't you read what you got? Okay, that's not what it says in the Hebrew text. It says in the Hebrew text, if I remember correctly, and Cain said to Abel his brother. And then the very next phrase that's in the text is, it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up and slew Abel. But what Cain said is missing. Because literally it doesn't say he talked with or talked to. The Hebrew text, he said. And you would, it's the way normally, you know, God said, and you'd expect some sort of message. It's the same formulation, and it's just not there. Now, whether it dropped out or it was not meant to be preserved, there's a little bit of a dispute about that, but it's a peculiar construction, to say the least. It does seem like something got lost. You're going to say something?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, some alternate texts have provided something. Let us go out into the field. And then, of course, that would be logical, and it came to pass when they were in the field that, you know, this thing happened. But as I say, there have been some of these small imperfections in the way the text has become transmitted to us. But as I said, every other evidence indicates that the imperfections are very tiny. That this text has come down with remarkable fidelity down through thousands of years. But as I said, this took a great deal of training because of the fact there was no vowel that were in the text itself. There were no word separations. People had to be very, very carefully trained. And so what it's saying about Ezra is that he was a skilled, highly skilled practitioner of all these complications, of which I need to add one more. He was also skilled in the oral law. Now, many of us tend to associate the oral law as something only from the intertestamental period that grew up somewhere in the Greek period and, of course, was further extended by the Pharisees into a real yoke upon the people that was a burden for them. But the oral law, as we will see in the next lecture, goes all the way back to Moses' day. And was developed throughout the Old Testament period. And so by the time of Ezra, there was a considerable body of oral law that had to be learned if one was to be an expert in the law. And so this, again, made the job very difficult. Next time we'll examine this. What I want you to do for your assignment for next time is you have some scriptures mentioned there in the assignment. What I would like you to do is to look at those scriptures and analyze them from one of the following perspectives. For example, with the first one and the second one, look at what is being said. There's a specific commandment being given that the people are supposed to do something. Try to figure out why it would be impossible for you to know how to do it, to literally carry out the instruction. Let's say you had a desire to reconstruct this law and live by it, run a society by it. You couldn't run it according to just the instructions that are given. Something's missing. In the case of Deuteronomy 17, how does that give evidence for the development of oral law? Something besides the literal, specific, written law. This is something I want you to see. Then, in terms of Jeremiah 17, why does that show some evidence that there had been some development of oral law? And the same thing with Haggai 2 and Amos 8. Haggai 2 and Amos 8 show that there must have been some development of oral law. And you should investigate that and see if you can figure out why. And then in Nehemiah 10, the last scripture, you actually have an example of oral law being created. Got an excellent illustration of oral law being created. The very moment when a piece of oral law was created is mentioned there in the text. And so that will familiarize you with that, and that will serve as the groundwork for the discussion we'll have next time about that, so you'll be able to participate. Okay, getting back to this then, as you can see, this was quite a difficult assignment, and so when it says that Ezra was a skilled practitioner, it is showing he was quite a distinguished and well-educated individual. Okay, following along then again in chapter 7 of Ezra, verse 6, this Ezra went up from Babylon. He was a ready scribe in the law of Moses, which the eternal God of Israel had given. And the king granted him all his requests. Ooh. Ezra made a request of the king. He gave him all his requests according to the hand of the eternal, his God, upon him. In other words, God gave him favor in the eyes of the king, so the king would give an affirmative answer to his request. Now, what is it that was involved in the request? Now, verse 10. Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of the eternal and to do it, and to teach in Israel statutes and judgments. Apparently, there was a need to teach the people the statutes and judgments of God. They had lost sight of them. And he had asked for permission of the king to be allowed to do this. Now, this is expanded for our edification beginning with verse 11. This is a copy of the letter that the king Artaxerxes gave to Ezra the priest, the scribe, even a scribe of the words of the commandments of the eternal and of his statutes to Israel. Artaxerxes, king of kings, which is a typical Persian title, because it was an empire with various subject peoples, and he was sort of the king over all of them. Artaxerxes, the king of kings, unto Ezra the priest, a scribe of the law of the God of heaven, perfect peace and at such a time. I make a decree that all they of the people of Israel and of his priests and Levites in my realm, which are minded of their own free will to go up to Jerusalem, go with you. So we have another return, you see. We've already seen one under Sheshbazzar, one under Zerubbabel. Now we have a third organized return. Obviously, people drifted back in smaller groups too, but this is a third major return. For as much as you are sent of the king and of his seven counselors. Oh, he is sent specifically by the king. That's a significant point. He is commissioned by the king directly to do what? Some have mistakenly construed that Ezra was sent as some sort of civil governor of Judea. This is not what it says. It says, you are sent of the king to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God which is in your hand. Now, how would we put that in maybe simpler everyday English? What was he commissioned to do, given this description here? Dan? Yeah. To investigate the spiritual condition of Judea to see if they were keeping the law. It says, to investigate, you see, to inquire about Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God, which is in your hand. You see, this is what he's been asked to do. Dave, you have a comment or a question? Mm-hmm. And the oral. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a typical Persian phrase for the God of Israel. It's also a typical phrase the Jews themselves used to describe God in this period of time, which is why the book of Ezra fits so naturally the Persian period. It's a unique way even Jews in secular correspondence referred to God. They referred to him as the God of heaven. It's just a title. It's Ezra's God. It's not the God or his God, personally, yeah. It's Ezra's God. So it's to make an inquiry in Jerusalem about what is the spiritual state of the country and how faithful are they in keeping the law of God. Now, why should he even be concerned about it? Why should the king even care? Because we've already seen that the kings did care. That was part of their policy. They wanted all the gods of the empire to be happy. Now, if a people was not properly serving their God, that God would not be too happy, and he wouldn't be blessing the empire. So that was no good. You see, they were always concerned in this way. Now, another part of his commission is to carry the silver and gold which the king and his counselors have freely offered to the God of Israel, whose habitation is in Jerusalem. This is part of that policy of honoring all the gods. He has sent his own freewill offering. And all the silver and gold which you can find in all the province of Babylon, with the freewill offering of the people and of the priests, offering willingly for the house of their God which is in Jerusalem. So he authorizes them to take up a collection and transport those valuables to Jerusalem to further embellish the temple. That you may speedily, with this money, buy bullocks, rams, lambs, with their meat offerings and drink offerings, and offer them upon the altar of the house of your God, which is in Jerusalem. Whatsoever shall seem good to you and to your brethren to do with the rest of the silver and the gold, that do after the will of your God. The vessels also that are given thee for the service of the house of your God, deliver them before the God of Jerusalem. Whatever more shall be needful for the house of your God, which you shall have occasion to bestow, bestow it out of the king's treasure house. And again, we already commented, he put sort of an upper limit on how much Ezra could spend. And then, of course, we come down here to verse 23. Whatever is commanded by the God of heaven, let it be diligently done for the house of the God of heaven. Why should there be wrath against the realm of the king and his sons? Now, another part of his commission begins in verse 24, which links up with verse 14. In verse 14, we were told that Ezra was to sort of conduct an inquiry into the way spiritual affairs were being conducted in Jerusalem. This ties in with that. We certify you that touching any of the priests and Levites and singers and porters and Nethinims, or ministers of this house, it shall not be lawful to impose toll, tribute, or custom upon them. The king is granting these functionaries, these religious officials, tax exemptions. You see, which was typical. You, Ezra, after the wisdom of your God that is in your hand, in other words, according to the law, set magistrates and judges, which may judge all the people that are Avar Nahar, all such as know the laws of your God. In other words, he is not given authority to set up magistrates over everybody in Avar Nahar. He is given authority to set up judges over all the Jews who live in the satrapy called Avar Nahar, and teach you them that know them not. In other words, he is instructed to instruct the people who don't know the law of God what the law of God is, and to set up religious judges, religious courts, to judge them according to that religious law. Whosoever will not do the law of your God and the law of the king, let judgment be executed speedily upon him, whether it be death or banishment or confiscation of goods or imprisonment. Now, the reason for this spelling out of specific punishments is not that these are the only punishments allowed. It means let judgment be placed upon them, whatever it is, in other words. Whatever, whether it's death, banishment, confiscation, whatever the particular punishment the law requires, you have authority to impose. Now, Ezra ends this section with a personal comment. After he quotes the text of Artaxerxes' letter, or decree, he remarks, "Blessed be the eternal God of our fathers, which has put such a thing as this in the king's heart, to beautify the house of the Eternal which is in Jerusalem, and has extended mercy to me before the king and his counselors, and before all the king's mighty princes. And I was strengthened as the hand of the Eternal my God was upon me, and gathered together out of Israel chief men to go up with me." Now, why is it that Ezra made this request to begin with? That he be allowed to go and investigate the spiritual condition of Judea and, quote, to put things back on track, as he was given permission to do. Well, I think it should be obvious. Yeah. And that should not be surprising either. The temple was finished in 515 B.C. This is now 458. What was the spirit and motivation of the people in finishing the temple? Sue?
Because they wanted to
Yeah. But year followed year, followed year, followed year, and all things continued as they had been from the beginning. It's no wonder that people began to ask, if I can borrow a New Testament phrase, where is the promise of His coming? Since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they have from the beginning. There was a great letdown in terms of the feelings of the people because their expectations had not been fulfilled.
Yes.
Reign of Xerxes would have been the prior reign. When, how early in the year of Xerxes, I don't know when these events took place in his reign. So I don't know. Couldn't give you a direct answer. Yeah. They had had, of course, that fright, you might say as well, which they had been saved out of. But there had been no day of Yahweh. There had been no exaltation of Israel above the nations. Their messianic hopes they may have pinned on Zerubbabel never were fulfilled. And from what we can tell about their conditions in Judea, economically they were still suffering from a significant lack. What I would like you to do is to consider, in this connection for next time as well, the book of Malachi. I would like you to read through it. It's not a very long book. Chapters 1 through 3. And sort of make a list of the conditions that the book of Malachi is commenting upon. And then think about it in the context of this as a background. And I think you'll see that it provides a logical explanation for why the conditions would be like Malachi is showing. Okay? And we'll pick up with that next time.